Hello and welcome to The Culture Brokers, stories from 1.5 generation immigrants. In this series, we explore the unique experiences of individuals who immigrate to a new country before adolescence. Each episode will discuss different themes relevant to this demographic as they navigate through life while trying to understand what it means to belong to different cultures.
Hey everyone! In today's episode, Mana and I do some catching up on some of the changes in our lives, with me recently relocating to Calgary and Mana making the decision to move back home with her parents. We talk about the struggles of navigating the residual teen angst that's sometimes triggered by our parents, Maslow's hierarchy of immigrant needs, and we reflect on the real traumas that are lingering in the hearts of many immigrant communities. Culture Brokers is always all about emphasizing the stories we develop and carry with us through our lives. And we spend some time together talking about the language we think in, our perception of social cohesion and how that's changed over the years, and the healing and letting things be. We hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. Thank you for listening.
So, you know, like a year ago is this just recently was the anniversary of the shooting down of the plane that was leaving Iran. It was a passenger plane. It was shot down. I mean, they say it's by accident, but whatever. It was just a tragic event. It was shot down by the government, forces. And this plane was on its route to come to Canada. And so many of the passengers were from the Iranian Canadian diaspora. And it was just a very difficult and traumatic event for obviously the people who were actually like affected by it and lost like family in that, in the crash, but just the general broader community, because we all related to that. We're like, yeah, like they were coming back from their holidays. They were all coming back to like, you know, this school to do their PhD in engineering and like X and Y and Z and all these different like profiles that just are very much like relatable, I guess. So it could have been any of us. And that really, having it be the first anniversary just recently, like it was a big topic of conversation in my family, in the broader family, online, like all the different like kind of sources of information that like we like, whether it's the news or some like Persian like news anchor, you know, like my dad listens to like every single day. This was just very much up and alive in all the family conversations. And through that and some other similar experiences, I'm realizing that like the reality is, and I don't want to say this for everybody, but a lot of like immigrant communities are coming with some deep levels of trauma. Like they really are, you know, like talking to my parents about like, they'll share some random stories from their youth, you know, during the revolution in Iran. And then also casually mentioned that like, oh, this friend that was just mentioned in the story was then executed by the government. But they'll say it in the most like chill way. But it's not that they're chill about it. It's just that that was such a reality for them that they no longer are going to get like affected emotionally if they're going to talk about it. Whereas for me, I'm like, what? Like, that's insane. Like, especially now that I'm at that same age, like, I can't even imagine someone I know having been executed by the government, you know? So so basically what it's done for me is realize while like there's almost like a Maslow's hierarchy image in my head of the immigrant like needs, and the basic needs, the foundational needs are where my parents are at, I think generally maybe first generation immigrants, but where it's like, okay, so long as I live and my family lives in a society where there's their basic safety and civil rights are protected, like, and they have a genuine chance of like for economic prosperity, I've done well. I'm okay with that. Whereas I feel like with me and us and the 1.5s and the second generations, we're like, we've kind of accepted those rights, and now we're on the higher parts of the pyramid being like, okay, but no, I also want like equity in my social interactions. I want, I don't want just like the basic level of like equal opportunity. I want to go deep into the institutional history and institutional structures and make sure I'm treated the same way. And I don't think there's one that's right or the other, like, why is the other one's wrong? But I think like a year ago, 5 years ago, I was just very frustrated as to why, like, my parents or their generation didn't have the same level of like passion and appreciation about these issues as I did. But now I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. Like, you, like, I feel like there's only like a handful of things you can kind of like battle at a time, and they've had their share. Like, they're like, I fucking went through, first of all, just like the immigrating at an older age with a family, coming to a new country, like not fully comfortable with the language and all that stuff. I already did that. I'm done. I don't need to go do some more self-work and try and learn how to accept my like unconventional daughter. and like, you know, I say that with a grain of salt. Like, it's not like I'm now gonna just, like I said earlier, like submit to that, but I just feel like I just have a deeper understanding as to like, okay, so you don't need to do more work right now. Like, I mean, if you do, that's great, but I don't feel like I have the right to ask for that anymore. And you know, like, it's to me especially, that has been the biggest, like reverting back to my 16-year-old self, as we're saying, like, it's had its challenges. I'm not going to lie about that. I also totally agree. Like, I feel like I also notice myself acting less maturely in certain situations than I'm used to. But the biggest benefit it's had is that it's given me this opportunity to really deeply know the day-to-day kind of like habits or experiences of my parents in a more detailed way than I've ever gone the chance to before. And through that, I've had these realizations that I just described. Like, I can't compare the end result. Like, I can't compare myself to them as if we're all from the same thing. We're not. Like, we're their history and their experiences and values and what it means to be happy, what it means to be a family, is just, it comes from such a different place, you know?
Recognizing that there's not one way of thinking, it seems like such a simple statement to make, but it's so bold and it's so truly revolutionary for our families. And I think for a lot of immigrant families, that in the context of how, like, a child, right? Like, just taking it back for a second and getting back to and tying it back into what you're saying. When you come, let's say you immigrate here with your parents, which is what we did. And there's this inherent assumption, because you're all newcomers, that you kind of are, and like, it's a family unit. So that those are your people. And that's your root connection, especially when we've been kind of like plucked out of, let's say, like, where you've been ancestrally, right? So I think cognitively and like from a psychological perspective, I can totally understand why us growing up as kids and our parents wanted to relate to each other and wanted each other to see our individual lives from our own perspectives, because, and one of them have to be right, because you're looking for what you think is like cohesion, and you want it to be sort of rooted in the same values. And I think there's a lot of like different layers to this, obviously, but with parents trying to try that extra harder to make sure their kids are not straying from their values and what they think is like, you know, the right thing. So the psychology of graduating through society here and what you're supposed to do, what that looks like, what does success look like, what does integration look like? And we both had concepts of integration just in different ways. For our parents, maybe it was like, we've talked about this before, but, you know, go to school, do well. They don't really care about whether you're going to do all these X, Y, and Z fun things like out of school. If it doesn't look good on a resume, if it doesn't look good on a school application, like, they weren't really invested. And it caused a lot of discord between, you know, I don't want to say us and them, but like, yeah, us and them, in that there was all these other experiences that we were having that we felt like they couldn't share because they didn't share that value. And there's like this frustration bubbling
when we are, you know, in both of you in our case, where we're like interested in this social justice areas, and then we're like, whoa, how are our parents not like, you know, how do they not, they don't get it, right? And like you said, like there's that, there's, why aren't they as passionate about like these like systemic disparities and like wanting to do something? And sometimes it even feels like they're almost, they're so fearful for you that they actually want you to disengage from some of those things. And that can be equally frustrating. But hearing you describe what you just said with, you know, the news that they're consuming, because in a way that news portal is their, that news source is their portal to their roots and the things that they care about. And not to say that we don't care about them, but that is like their direct source of information. And it's normalized. There's that news layer that, of course, a lot of the things we see and read, it is normalized pain because it's happening to someone else, somewhere else. And you don't have to really think about it in terms of how it's intersecting with your day-to-day life. But it, I also think there's so much trauma that we don't appreciate, like you said, seeing those nuances now, it's so powerful. And I want to take a second and blame the system like we always do and we should continue doing, because, you know, studying sort of this immigration citizenship law in the context of Canada, which is something that I know about from a secondhand experience and through our podcast of 1.5 and what it means to have the 1.5 experience of kids that are also immigrants, but there's not discourse surrounding our struggles of integration, which is like we've talked about, right? Like balancing ourselves in the, and balancing a sense of identity, creating a sense of identity while we're surrounded by Canadian sort of tropes of what it means to be Canadian, what it means to act Canadian and sound Canadian, look Canadian. Those are legitimate struggles for us, absolutely. And, you know, we, that's what we're going to continue talking about. But taking a second to sort of reflect on how the, how Canadian immigration law is built on treating immigration as part of this nation building exercise. And we hear a lot of things like, you know, Canada's so multicultural and Canada doesn't have like, you know, what is it? Not the melting pot, but a mosaic, right? And then you read about these dead ass, racist ass laws where it was fully like transcribed in the legislation to be very conditional based on someone's ethnic origin. So we have like immigration that had taxed the first sort of cohort of Chinese immigrants. And that eventually was like, a, you know, we're talking about $500 per person, like to come to Canada, and how much racism like existed at that time at the faced by Chinese immigrants, like some really, really terrible things, and how that same sort of legislation, the Immigration Act, that was what it was called then sort of like transformed to be, okay, well, we're gonna be discriminatory towards like people from Japanese origins and like very focused on East Asia because, you know, God forbid anyone else come here. And then eventually in like, you know, you see your first group of like Indian immigrants. And then you have stories where people like, there's a whole ship of people who are, you know, who came, who sailed to Canada to seek refuge, and they were not admitted, refused entrance. And they actually spent 2 months in a harbor. And this is like in the West Coast in Vancouver. And then, you know, the boat had to sail back to India. Like a whole ass boat. So then you realize like, okay, some of this trauma, the things that they were so scared of just wanting to be like, you said, that first level of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's not just in anyone's head, obviously, which we knew, but when you sort of appreciate the extent to which immigration in Canada has been very overtly discriminatory, and it also manifests in policy, it manifests in practice of those policies and in laws and statute that can look at face value to be neutral, but actually have such harmful origins. So it makes complete sense then when you realize that immigration has always been characterized as a privilege. It's not a right. And by that virtue, there's like so much inclusion and exclusion that comes from that. But for our parents as immigrants and who had to actually interface with this system, right? And a lot of 1.5s, we don't have that same appreciation of what it means to engage with the system because we're not the ones that are applying for immigration. We're not the ones dealing with the status and supporting documentation. And then, you know, writing a test and having to, like, I don't know about you, but I remember going to like my citizenship oath and I just like, it was a day off school. I just wore a dress. I think I have a picture. That was it. Like there was really no labor on my end, right? So maybe because of the lack of engagement with the system that is designed to be traumatic, that is designed to be like to remind you that, hey, like Canada has its sovereign absolute right over our borders. Like you're lucky to be here. Take this oath and prove it. Yeah. Like maybe us as children of immigrants and as like young immigrants, we don't see it as a privilege. We see it as a right. Like I am here. Hey, I'm struggling to be here. Like I'm at school and I have to really try hard to like, you know, differentiate myself from my parents and at school. And that's a very conscious thing I'm doing every day so I can belong here. And this is all I know. So of course I'm going to take advantage of that. Right. But what it's resulted in long-term is sort of this, because of our entrance point and our experience of that entrance point has been so different, it has naturally led to this pretty big gap in how we, with power of this, like, let's say we see it as a right rather than a privilege, the power that comes from that sense of thinking something is your right, it can lead to different, very, very different senses of like, just throughout the whole system as you continue to like go through school, as you get your first job, as we have relationships and friendships, like it does manifest itself in a very significant way. And I think that that's been a point of contention between us and our parents, that what they had to experience from jump then has been internalized. And then it's like, okay, they just want to make sure that we're like, and we hear it all the time, and this like the psychology of like, okay, get your, you know, graduate, go to school, graduate, get a job, you know, have a partner, and then be with them, and then maybe have some kids. And like, that is the extent of maybe the dreams that they have for you. And sometimes it can be offensive because you're like, that's all you think of for me. Like, do you realize how much I'm doing X, Y, Z, na, na, na? Like, I do that. And, you know, thinking of the example I gave earlier, because I couldn't think of one, like, what does my mom do that really cheeses me? But like, there's so many little things and they stem from this place where they do want to like have the safety. And the issue becomes, again, like we don't have to surrender to the psychology, as you said, but both sides realizing that there is more than one way to view many, like there's many perspectives to any given conversation. And rather than us trying to grapple like, okay, like whose perspective is superior or holds more weight, it's actually like many of their perspectives are of course very valid, and they have a range that we need to appreciate as well. And that needs to be a right that we feel we're being heard and how, you know, we talk about things as well. But I think when we didn't have the language being younger and just realizing like that whole Maslow's hierarchy of needs thing is bullshit, because I think the fundamental need that you need to have within community is like being understood, feeling heard, feeling safe. Like those should be core. And that's how we can build on like habitat. That's how we build on, you know, like food and security. Like it's not just like, it's not this binary of like safety in a physical sense and safety in a metaphysical, like, oh, millennials, you just love, and Gen Zs just want to feel safe and like, what is it? Snowflake culture of like, but it's like safety, truly, safety needs to be psychologically provided as well. Like, I feel safe with you. I feel safe to talk about things without judgment, without fear. And a lot of the ways that we felt so heavily affected by the ways that our parents, as immigrant parents, kind of impose some of their values around these things, comes from a place where for them, like, they really saw it one way. And I think they still do, where there is no psychological safety. Like, it sounds so scary when I say that, but some of their experiences, not everyone's, but many folks' experience, even to this day, is very much grounded in like coming from places and practices, or maybe even an identity that they hold that is actually, you know, persecuted. And there is no freedom of thought, because if someone finds out that you're thinking this way, there is going to be a repercussion, and they hold that with them, you know? So I think these realizations can be both so heavy, but at the same time, so transformative, because when you see your parents and how they consume news, how they react to that kind of stuff, how they then characterize the rest of their day, and you juxtapose that with us, who, like, I can get bad news about something that has happened to like a friend, and there's a lot of bad shit happening right now, and it'll for sure throw my day off. Even if I have to work, even if I have to study, even if I have to do whatever, I'm not able to just parse it out. Whereas in many ways, they've shown significant resilience by just, you know, getting back up and like doing what they have to do to get through their day. And like, we don't, not everyone can say they can do that, you know? So what does that tell you about strength? And like, is their strength better than ours? Like, we don't have to go into things being better. I think that's the problem. Like, it shouldn't be this hierarchy. It should just be like this fluid state of understanding and learning from one another without feeling like blocked and like defined by that, by the way you think. And like, knowing that all of these things can also be temporary. Like, you can feel very strongly about something one day, and then maybe tomorrow it's not, you don't feel that way anymore. And that's okay. We don't have to be bogged down with previous identity markers of us at 18, 23. It could ebb and flow. And I think that's sort of the point of these conversations.
So I think what you're saying is like, it being a transformative experience is exactly sort of what I wanted to get across. Like, I think, and like it being a fluid experience, I think that's, I guess, like my biggest, like new lesson learned in the last little while. I don't know if it's just like the effects of the pandemic, like getting us to be a little bit more like reflective and more solitude, more grateful for like the fewer things we have going for us. But I think it's like, I'm at a point now where I'm realizing, even though there shouldn't technically be a hierarchy, like it still very much for me feels like there is. And whereas before I was pushing and trying to like resist or force some sort of understanding onto my extended family as to like why we need to go beyond just appreciating the basic needs, like why we need to have higher expectations and demand more of the system that we're like participating in. Now I'm like, okay, like, not that you're right and I was wrong, like you said, that it doesn't have to be one or the other, but I see where you're coming from. I see why you are approaching things the way that you are, and that's just like a reflection of what you're willing to put up with. And I see how both your approach and my approach can coexist peacefully. I think up until recently, it's been a lot of like, we have to be on the same side. And now I'm like, okay, so let's go back to the beginning. Like, something like you just feeling more certain and more calm with the, more at peace with the idea that if your kids are married, then things are making sense to you. Things are working out the way that they should. Like, you can keep thinking that, and you can keep approaching it that way. And what I have to do now is, instead of trying to get you to see things from my perspective, which is what I feel like I was doing my whole life up until now, is learn how to coexist peacefully, knowing that my perspective might change a little, might be a little bit different than yours. And then maybe even more importantly, making sure that I approach the next generation with a little bit more mindfulness, maybe, to maybe, like, you know, like, not pass on similar pressures, but just really, like, it sounds like a simple thing. I don't know if people go through this at different stages and I'm just, like, late to it, but just knowing how to make enough space in my head, in my mind, in my heart for two conflicting ways of being, like, it's just, it's, for me, it's been very healing. And, you know, everything about, from day one, about 1.5 has always been about, like, the peaceful coexistence of these two different ideologies, these two different identities. And only now am I realizing that so much of the healing is going to have to be about letting things be. Whereas I don't want to be promoting being passive, but I just, like, you know, when you're talking to me about, like these historical events that have shaped, like, the external, like, the macro, like, immigration policies in Canada, like, these are things that were always so important for me. I felt like it was very important for me to pass this knowledge on to the extended family. And recently I've just been like, I don't think that I need to, like, I don't think that they want to hear it. I don't think that it's even, like, their job anymore to hear it. Like, I think it's more on us and future generations who don't have the same types of traumas to tackle these challenges, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also, I want to know if you notice anything that you've picked up on, like, the lightness on your communication. I think, like, the way I've been reflecting a lot on how we think, people think in different languages. And that was almost so bizarre for me to realize, because I think I asked my parents last year, I was like, what language do you guys think in Bangla, like in Bengali? And they said, yeah. And I was like, okay, that obviously makes sense. And I thought about it for a long time. And a part of it, I was sad because I was like, I think in English. And, like, as someone that is so proud of my language, I'm glad I can speak it, to not have moments, like, very rare moments am I thinking in Bengali, right? Like, I'm generally, and sometimes to the point that even in how I communicate, it's so comfortable in English when it comes to complex sort of feelings-based expressions, that my parents, my mom and I will have, you know, conversations where she'll actually at one point be like, stop speaking to me in English. And I'm like, well, I can't express these things to you in my language. Like, I don't have the words for them. But thinking of this whole, like, thinking of language thing has really helped me in terms of putting myself in their position. Because a lot of ways that language manifests in thinking and communication is actually, compared to the English language, which is, like, in, you know, kind of not as, I mean, I speak English, but I'm just going to go ahead and diss it anyways. Like, it's not as profound in terms of some really beautiful languages, like, you know, Farsi and, like, other languages that are ancient. And so they come with so much richness. And, like, English is very, what's the word, like, phonetically, like, weird in some ways. Like, some words don't really make sense. And some words, when you transliterate them, it really washes down the meaning of them. Anyways, all of this to say that this last time going back home, just spending a few weeks with my parents over the holidays, and first time being home with, like, my partner and someone that, you know, has not previously not been integrated into my family, because, you know, it was kind of an uphill battle to get here. But this past trip was so healing for us, because all of us, because I think being back with them in this context, like you said, where they have all these unfair, I guess, allowances that they give to people who are like, okay, well, you're married, so therefore you are allowed to behave or speak in the XYZ way, because it's almost like you're a little more legitimate. And this is not all immigrant families, but like my family for sure, very traditional, like relatively conservative. I think up until a point where you can even have, I have cousins that have had partners forever, like decades. And there's still a certain level of like almost illegitimacy that comes from not viewing them as like completely, they haven't done something right, you know, not everything right. And so there's always that component missing. And so being around my parents in this elevated status and sort of navigating, thinking, is this going to come with a lot of like changes? Like, are we going to be a completely different family? And of course not. Like, my parents are still the same parents. They still have, my mom's was still, you know, nagging me on the same things. But this time around, having an external person, my partner was, and he pointed out, he's like, your language, because we don't speak the same language, he's like, your language is very dramatic. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, you know, just some of the idioms you guys have, it's just so like dramatic. And you know, I thought about it and I was like, you're so right. Like, Bangla as a language is very poetic in nature. And though we don't speak it in poetic prose, a lot of the expressions are very like dramatized, in the sense where if you like the expression for like, let's say you forget something, is the same expression you would make or like enunciate if someone was to like get hit with a car, you know? Like, it's a very, it's very fun in that way, because like some words are really like funny, but at the same time, these words are very like, it almost sounds like something very major is happening, even though it could be like, oh, someone just tripped. But like the way you would emote to that is with a great sort of like gasp and like, oh my gosh. And in English, the only way to like transliterate this would be if someone was to say, oh my gosh, or oh my God, right? Which is not the same as like expressions that are rooted in language. And him saying this objectively was so like helpful for me, because then I realized a lot of the ways my mom and my dad, and like I'll just focus on my mom, because if it hasn't already been clear, like mommy issues and immigrant girls, like I just think it's a real thing, and I feel like I talk about my mom all the time, so I'm just gonna go with that. But I realized like some of the things that she says to me sometimes are not because of how she really necessarily views the subject or what she's saying or trying to express to me, but like the way it's literally in her head, the language she speaks in her head and the language she speaks verbally and orally and like communicates, there is a literal gap in my interpretation of what she's saying, because I'm now hearing it and thinking in English and responding to it in my head in English. And a lot of times this means that things that don't have to be so serious, I am taking very seriously, but there are, and then it'll be annoying because she will respond to me by saying, you're not understanding what I'm saying, or like, you are too Canadian, so you don't get it, right? And that used to be a really big pain point, because I'd be like, oh my God, like we can't agree on certain things, and it'd be such a frustrating experience. But now I kind of just laugh, and I've actually said to my parents, I think a few times now, like, do you guys realize how dramatic this language is? Like, do you realize that the ways that you're responding are so unnecessarily like pronounced because of the origins of like even the word you're using, because it's a building block of communication, right? So I'm curious to know what do you think of that? Because I brought it up to a friend, because she went home recently to Zimbabwe, and I was asking her, like, do you feel like there's words in your language that are like that, the way people communicate, and even when you go back home, these are things you pick up on, right? Like, and that bother you, because that's when you're like, oh, I feel so Canadian right now, because people are gonna ask you questions about like, oh, how much money do you make, or like so like, when are you going to get married? Or like, oh, you've gained a lot of weight. And like the things that they say can be so off-putting, but it's also because we're interpreting it in a different lens. And it's helpful to remind yourself that, yo, like, English is not the baseline for everything. And so, like, don't take – if you're thinking in English and you're reacting in English thought, then you should at least factor in the, like, the context of the person that's speaking and whether this would be that offensive or that, like, derogatory or rude or whatever in the context of the language that they're speaking. So yeah, curious to get your thoughts on that, just because like Farsi is such a ancient language.
Like, I totally know. It just makes me laugh so hard because we have had really different experiences. We do come from different cultures and families, but yet there's so many stories you describe where I'm like, I know exactly what you're talking about. That whole like moment of miscommunication, and then I get called dramatic or like too Canadian. Like such a thing. But I what's interesting for me is, like, totally agree. I think Persian is a little bit more of a dramatic language in terms of, like, how they describe things, how they show affection, all that stuff. But at the same time, it's also a little bit more of, like, an evasive language or maybe an evasive method of communication. So one thing that we always struggle with, and, like, now it's more of, like, a joke, but like they always say that I'm too blunt, like I'm too straightforward for a typical Persian girl, let's say. And this comes up a lot, like with my family, they're used to it. And like a lot of my cousins are even more like, you know, westernized than I am. They're either Canadian or they're like, they're not even fully, like they're half-half. But when I go back to Iran or when we go to like a Persian grocery store or like interact with just like someone in the diaspora that like is more of an outsider, my parents always almost like step in because they're like, yeah, you're like the way you're either not picking up on the hints that they're dropping or you're saying something a little bit too intensely and we need to like water it down. And you know, it's funny and like, you know, whatever, you know, like we have come to kind of join in on the jokes. But when in the day to day, yeah, like the way you think, the way you are taught to, and because like it's so for you and I, for example, like I think learning to think in English, which I actually have a very distinct memory of when that started to happen for me, because I remember being so obsessed. I think I mentioned this to you before, being so obsessed with getting out of ESL and being so determined not to have that title that I would talk about it a lot. And then I remember some adult in my life told me that, you know, you've learned a language or you've mastered it when you start to think in that language. And so anyways, I just remember being like 11 and being like, oh, I'm finally catching myself thinking in English. And so what happened though is like throughout the years, obviously strengthening your language as you're growing up, but especially when you enter the workforce, especially when you enter a type of industry that we are a part of, the communication is such an important part of, such an important skill set to have. So I think that's been one of the more unfortunate realizations of the last like 5 to 6 years, where I think I've gotten better at, I've invested energy thoughtfully and sometimes like obviously subconsciously into getting better at communicating in English, which is helping me in different parts of my life. But then it's making me get worse at being able to, like, I'm not matching it with at home with my Farsi. And so when my dad and I, my mom and I are starting to talk about something that requires a little bit more of like an advanced like vocabulary or just, it's a conversation that's a little bit deeper. That's when I catch myself using so much more English, dropping so much more English words in it. And while they understand what I'm saying on the surface, I know there's so much that's lost in the process. And the same, like vice versa as well. And this is one of those things where I feel like it's on me, to be honest. I've met enough people who have, like, at least I was born in Iran and I would go back here and there. I've met people who've never even, like, their parents immigrated, but they were born here or in the States and they've never gone back to Iran and their Farsi is amazing. So I know that that's something that, like, I should and hopefully will invest more energy in, like, to, so I can keep it up. But it does, when you think about like the minute experiences that the day-to-day interactions that like shape your relationship with your family. Yeah, I definitely think language is a barrier. And the fact that we've conditioned ourselves to think and express and perceive things through the filter of the English language is like one of the core differences probably between us.
Yeah, I also think like the fact that we all spoke to each other and our friends in English, like a lot of our formative time thinking in English, like, or factoring things in the English context, like it didn't help create these nuances when we were younger. And I think that's the whole, the 1.5, in that it's previous to, it's like during our adolescent years, which we know is like such a crucial time. It's so much identity building, so much development is happening, and so much is shaping our perception of the world, our perception of ourselves at that time, that when you're at school and then you're talking to your friends and everyone's sort of like talking in English, and like it was great because you find friends this way that can resonate with your shit, that has, can relate to your story, can even, you know, support you by just saying that, yeah, like my parents are, I'm also relating to this and this is happening to me. And so it created this whole echo chamber, I would say, of our own experiences. And it's not until you're a lot older. And I think even our episode with Hamza, like that's what it was so great to reflect on, that the whole parents thing, and it's not a shared experience. Like none of this is one monolith of an experience, but you do come to a point where you see a lot of them in you and you see you in them. And it, like, of course, it's like biology, and it's the fact that you guys were together and shared so much of your life together. And it also then helps you realize that you're no longer in that survival stage of your life where you're trying so hard to assert an identity that it's separate from your parents and perhaps more in line with your peers. It's not as simple as that. Now that we're, you know, working or in this quote-unquote world of adulthood, that's when you realize some of the struggles and the ways that we are going to navigate things like, you know, let's say out of work commitments, like things like work-life balance when it comes to socializing and eating and like what foods you're interested in and all these other very surface level, like I'm just talking very surface level sort of connections. You will ultimately pivot back to the origins of some of these things and to your parents. And if you are around them or if you get to see them a little bit more, then you might be able to draw some of these linkages and appreciate them a little bit more to be like, okay, you know what? I can also be a little honest with how shitty I was as a adolescent growing up, hiding a whole bunch of shit that was, that I felt, and I was justified to hide them. I'm not going to like out myself here, but I was justified to hide them because I felt like I wouldn't be understood in the context of my home. But then that also perpetuated their suspicions. And then as you get older, they don't just disappear overnight. And that sense of like discord they have with you will manifest in how maybe they communicate or how they respond to you sharing something. And it can really get frustrating, but there's no point in time where you can just pass the buck on, because if you don't really sit with yourself and like go inward to be like, okay, well, why am I frustrated here? Like, what's the need? I think I saw a tweet that was like, with conflicts, a lot of times just asking, okay, what's the need here, can be really helpful, because sometimes the need is like, I just want to be heard. Sometimes the need is much deeper than that. I want to be accepted, or I want to be, you know, I want you to feel proud of me, whatever. Like it can be some deep shit, but assessing that just so you know what it is in your own like heart and your own mind is so powerful, because at least if you're not going to be able to receive it from them in that moment in time, you at least know what the need was. And for future, you'll either communicate it better or you'll just have to give that, like, that feeling of satisfaction to yourself. Like, hey, I understand me. Like, I get me. And that's doing a lot better than I, you know, than I was doing 5-6 years ago, where the need is there, but not only is it unspoken, not only does it not exist in, like, the spaces that you operate in, but it's also unknown to yourself. And, like, the lack of, like, all the ambiguity does not help feel good about yourself and feel good about your identity. And I think I've been thinking a lot about this, and that's definitely, like, the space that I'm in lately, to just be like, I have to at least know myself, know my shit, know my insecurities, know my, know what I want. And I'll have my back. And it's not to say that I'm promoting this, like, isolationist approach to life. I just think a lot of times we're going to be projecting to everyone and anyone around us until we have a good sense of what that is.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And I think I'm glad you brought up the Hamza episode, because one of the things I appreciated the most about our conversation with him is that he made me realize just how much of how much of the identity building process as a 1.5 generation immigrant is closely tied to the fact that you're an adolescent when you're doing it. I think, you know, like, that need to define yourself, like, it's like, I think sometimes looking at it or looking back retrospectively at this conversation at this age, I get lost in this, like, adult perspective of, like, this culture versus that culture, whereas obviously retrospect is, like, hindsight is not 2020, actually. Like, it's such a subjective thing to be doing, but, like, if I were to somehow go back to when I was 13, I would be able to tap into that and just recognize just how much of my struggles had to do with me being a teenager and just really wanting to, for things to make sense. And there's so much healing in what you're saying. Like, there's so much peace and calm that's brought into your life once you stop trying to make things happen and stop trying to make someone else see things from your perspective or judge yourself for not seeing things from someone else's perspective, and doing exactly what you described, which is to be like, okay, you know what? Like, I am the way I am. I need only my affirmation, and the rest, and through that, you'll be more, like, compassionate towards how you, towards other people in your life, towards other experiences in your life. And so that's kind of exactly what I meant when I first started talking. Like, I think if we were to compare this to the last 5 conversations we've had in the last 5 episodes or 6 episodes, so much of that was about how, you know, the society, the community is going to, like, behave, how we're going to make it better, how we're going to make things better for the next generation, all that kind of macro level stuff. Whereas just the experience of being stuck at home has made me think about, like, it's like how you can't separate any of that from your daily dynamics, your daily struggles. I'm thinking about this and just how much of what we're saying has to goes back to boundary setting on a personal level, not on, like, a community macro level. And how much boundary setting has to do with, like, your relationship with yourself and what it means to become an adult, basically, and realize, like, these are necessary things that are essential for your survival. And I think the most interesting experience of this whole thing for me has been seeing that it's a double-edged, not a double-edged sword, but, like, as soon as you start accepting yourself in a more compassionate way, you start accepting others in a compassionate way. So going back to, like, my conversations with my parents, I just remember being so enraged so easily, you know, 5 years ago, they said something I didn't agree with, or they said something that I thought was, like, uninformed. And now I'm just like, I'm not going to make so many assumptions. Like, you know what you know, I know what I know, and there's a lot I could learn from you, and we could combine all our knowledge and we would still not know that much. Not to get too profound here, but just kind of like trust. Like, I feel like I would reflect and say that I feel I'm more okay with trusting the process than I was like a couple of years ago. I think a couple of years ago I felt very like determined to take control over this narrative and be like, okay, no, like, we have to let people know that there has to be there's this term called 1.5 and this is what it means and it's okay. And like, those things all hold true still, but it's almost like I at the subconsciously had like an end goal or an end state in mind. And now I'm just realizing how like absolutely out of reach that is. Like, the immigrant experience, this like shifting back and forth between on the spectrum, that's never going to stop, that's never going to end. And the only way to make meaningful impact in the conversation is to start by accepting that narrative. Where, like it's like weird admitting it out loud, but I think now looking back, with the first day we ever sat in a dingy library room trying to record, at the back of my head, that's probably what I thought. Like, I was like, oh my God, we're going to get this term out there and it's going to stop someone else from having some of the experiences that we had, or ensure that someone else has a better experience. But there's so much intensity and there's so much like, it's just, that just feels like such a black and white approach to things now. So I guess I feel fortunate, very lucky that we, like, this is something that I've always sort of said, like, the fact that you and I get to talk about an issue or talk about a concept and within 1 minute acknowledge that there's two very different ways of approaching this topic. For example, marriage, and whether that means you have your shit together or not. And just acknowledge that, you know, there's two different ways and they're both valid for their own reasons. And the person has a choice at the end of the day. And that's all. That's all I care about, I think.
One of the rules of Shams of Tabriz's, the book that you sent me that I absolutely love, and I'm still working my way through it, but I think one of the rules, I wrote it down and I thought it was so beautiful, and it was, everything and everyone is interconnected through an invisible web of stories. Whether we are aware of it or not, we are all in silent conversation. And I remember when I read that, I was like, that is what part of, I think, Culture Brokers is in my mind now. Like, you're right, the evolution of thinking once upon a time that we'd be able to mitigate people feeling that in-betweenness and the harms that can come from it at that crucial point in your life. But there's so many factors. There's so many variables that we obviously cannot account for. And everyone's experiences at the end of the day are so different that, at the very least, though, when we can share in storytelling and when we realize how interconnected all of that is, and that, like, it's kind of storing all these stories in some space, and at one point in time, someone's story comes back to you at a time of need. Like, you know, that's all. Like, that's it. That's all we could ever want, you know? So thinking of that as we come to a close, and maybe if you're around your parents and you're in the same bubble as them, give them a hug today.
Yeah, I should do that. I think more than a hug, they me like vacuuming the house would make them really happy. So maybe that's what I'll do.